For you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God! How vast is the sum of them! If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God! Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. What a beautiful psalm. Absolutely beautiful. Now, for many people, Psalm 139 is their favorite, and understandably so. Even Ezra, a Jewish rabbi during the Middle Ages, declared Psalm 139 to be the crown of all the psalms. And it may well be, for it brings us face to face with the wonder of God himself. Now, its title ascribes this psalm to David. It is the second of eight psalms at the end of this book attributed to him, these being Psalms 138 through 145. When he wrote Psalm 139, we don't know. We're not told. It is suggested that David wrote this toward the end of his life after many years of fellowship with the God who had made him and called him and then guided and protected him through all kinds of circumstances and every kind of experience of life. This psalm of David is intensely personal. He uses the first person pronoun, I, me, my, no less than 48 times in 24 verses. And in speaking of God, he uses the second person pronoun, you or yours, some 28 times. And in addition, David cries out, O Lord, O God, three times each. Now, this psalm falls nicely into four sections. The first three deal with different attributes of God as they relate to the individual. His omniscience in verses 1 to 6. His omnipresence in verses 7 through 12. His omnipotence in verses 13 through 18. And then the final section of verses 19 through 24 sets forth the inescapable response to the God who is all-knowing, everywhere present, and all-powerful. And that should be the response of complete loyalty, devotion to this wonderful God. One final thought before we begin our look at the first half of the psalm. We're going to save the second part until next week. The beginning and end of Psalm 139 form a literary device called an inclusio. This is where the beginning and end repeat the same thought either verbally or thematically. It is a common technique in Hebrew literature to mark thematic units or boundaries of thought. In this case, Psalm 139 begins with the declaration that God searches and knows. Yet at the end, David prays that God would search and know him personally. Obviously, God would do that without David's prayer. So David prays essentially that God would do what he would do anyway. In other words, because David knew what God was like and what God does, nothing was more important to him than being right with God and conforming his life to God's will. Knowing God made David conscious of his own insufficiency and led him to pray for divine leadership over his entire life. So the inclusio sets the tone for the entire psalm and suggests its main theme, which is that truth about God is intended to impact life. That's the theme of this. Truth about God is intended to impact life. It's not intended to be stored away up here, and that's what a lot of us do. It's intended to make that transfer from here to here out into our life. Another way to express this is that right thinking about God leads to right living. In other words, what we know about God must fuel within our hearts an ever-increasing desire to be what we ought to be as His children. Listen to what Dr. Warren Wiersbe says about this. What we think about God and our relationship to Him determines what we think about everything else that makes up our busy world. Other people, the universe, God's word, God's will, sin, faith, and obedience. Wrong ideas about God will ultimately lead to wrong ideas about who we are and what we should do. And this leads to a wrong life on the wrong path toward the wrong destiny. In other words, theology, the right knowledge of God, is essential to a fulfilled life in this world. David contemplated God and wrote for us a psalm whose message can only encourage us to be in a right relationship with Him. Now, with this in mind, let's turn our attention to the first 12 verses. In this first half of Psalm 139, David shares with us two wonderful truths about God and then applies these truths to his own life and, in essence, to our lives today. The first truth about God that he shares and its application is this: the omniscience of God. The omniscience of God, which means God is all-knowing. God is all-knowing. Its application is God knows everything about us. Everything about us. Our life is an open book before God. Look at verse 1. O Lord, You have searched me and known me. Now the Hebrew text for verse 1 contains only three words, many more in our English Bibles, but just three words in the Hebrew text. But their point is clear. The Hebrew verb translated searched is a word used elsewhere in the Old Testament to convey several things: spying out the land for an invasion, digging deep into a mine in order to discover wealth, investigating matters in preparation for a legal case to ensure the desired verdict. So what David is conveying is that with that kind of resolute thoroughness, God explores, He digs into, He examines us through and through to the point that we are an open book before God. Now to back this up, David reveals five areas of God's omniscience concerning our lives. The first is God knows everything we do. God knows everything we do. Look at the first part of verse 2. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. Now David uses an emphatic personal pronoun to open verse 2. Literally, it could be rendered this way. You alone know when I sit down and when I rise up. Also, David uses a figure of speech here called a merism, which employs a polar or opposite expression to designate totality. Here it is sitting down and rising up. In other words, David is not saying that God knows just our downs and our ups, but everything in between as well. That's a merism. That is, there is no activity that we do that is excluded from God's knowledge. God knows everything that we do. Second, God knows everything that we think. Look at the rest of verse 2. You understand my thought from afar. So our thoughts are an open book to God as well. That's kind of scary, isn't it? Think of what this means. How many thoughts do we have in a given day? I was curious about this, so I began to do some research, and I found out that it's open to great debate. It's wide open as to how many thoughts we have in a given day. I've read estimates of anywhere between 50 to 70,000 thoughts in a given day, up to 600,000 thoughts in a given day. Well, any way you look at it, it's a lot. The point is, God knows our thoughts no matter their number. And furthermore, the Hebrew word translated from afar suggests not just that God knows our thoughts here on earth from his distant, you know, heavenly abode, which is amazing in itself, but also he knows them long before we even think them, which is, how can you comprehend that, right? But he does. He knows them long before they enter our minds. That's why Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 8, "For your Father knows what you need before you ask him." Because he knows, you know, he knows what your needs are. He knows what you're going to be thinking about down the road. And then as well, no wonder Paul said in 2 Corinthians 10:5 that it was his goal to bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. That was Paul's goal in his life, to bring every thought. Why? Because he knew God was aware of his every thought, and so he wanted every thought to be brought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. And that's a challenge that we ought to take up in our own lives. Third, God knows everywhere we go. Look at verse 3. "You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all my ways." The verb scrutinize translates a Hebrew word which means to sift or winnow as grain. In other words, God knows where we go. His eye follows our course throughout the day, and he passes judgment on our choices as we go throughout the day. And I think, you know, young people, you need to remember that. We all do, but especially young people when they go places with their friends. God is very much aware of where you are going and what you are involved in. And so that's a very important truth. Fourth, God knows everything we say. Look at verse 4. "Even before there's a word in my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all." You know, it makes sense that if no thought escapes God, then certainly no word escapes him either. All the words that pass over our tongue, those already spoken and those yet unspoken, are known by God. As one writer put it, God knows every word of every language in every human being on every continent at every moment of every day. Wow. Just think of all the people right now that are talking. All over the world. God knows every one of their words. He has them. He's recording them. Now, obviously, this should have an impact on what we say. You know, lies, gossip, unkind words, off-color jokes, vulgar comments, you know, the disrespectful use of the Lord's name. This should never, ever come from our lips as God's children. Rather, we should speak only those things that God approves of. Our desire should be the same as David's when he wrote back in Psalm 19 and verse 14, "Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my Redeemer." Fifth and finally, God uses his knowledge of us to provide providential protection. Look at verse 5. "You've enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me." The word "enclosed" means hemmed in like a city under siege. So David is saying that God's knowledge of us is so complete that when we find ourselves in inescapable, difficult, you know, circumstances, situations, God already knows that. And he is there to protect us from all harm. This explains why his hand is upon us. Like a human father, God goes before us and behind us as his hand rests upon us. So putting this together, there's nothing, absolutely nothing about us that God does not know. He knows what we do. He knows what we think. He knows where we go. He knows what we say. He knows what we need. He knows everything, absolutely everything about us. Now notice in verse 6 how David reacts to God's omniscience. He exclaims, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too high. I cannot attain to it." So David is saying, in effect here, it blows my mind. That's what he's saying. It blows my mind when I think of God's knowledge of me. And I suspect that is how we feel as well this morning. Now, what should be our response to this first great truth about God? Well, for one thing, knowing God knows everything about us ought to engender in our lives reverence for God. It ought to engender reverence for God. You know, only the true God possesses complete knowledge. Anything else or anything less than that, well, he wouldn't be the true God. He wouldn't be God, right? But our God knows everything. Everything about everybody. And I suggest to you that this deserves, on our part, reverence for God. It should also generate comfort in us. Comfort in us. Knowing that God is not blind or oblivious to our lot in life, whatever we're going through, to all of its cares and concerns. And often we find ourselves, you know, in that spot between the rock and the hard place. And yet God is right there with us. So if you feel hemmed in this morning, know that God is closer to you than the most pressing circumstances of your life. And then finally, it should produce, on our part, careful conduct. Careful conduct. Knowing, as the writer of Hebrews says in chapter 4 and verse 13, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. All things are open and laid bare. God sees everything. He knows everything about us. And so that should do something within us and hopefully lead us to look at our life and how we conduct our life on a day-to-day basis. So the first truth about God that David shares is God's omniscience, which means God is all-knowing. And its application is God knows everything about us. Our lives are an open book before God. The second truth, and the final one for this morning, is the omnipresence of God. Omnipresence of God. Which means God is everywhere present at all times. God is everywhere present at all times. And its application is God stays with us constantly. God stays with us constantly. He never leaves our side. Look at verse 7. David asks two questions. Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? Now, some commentators believe that while David's initial response to God's omniscience was wonder, his next response seems to be flight. That he wanted to run away from God and hide. I don't think so. Rather, his questions point to the outright impossibility of escaping God's presence. David asked these questions with an expectation of an answer of nowhere. Where can I flee from your spirit? Nowhere. Where can I flee from your presence? Nowhere. I think that's what David is saying. So just as it is impossible to think, say, or do anything without God knowing it, so it is impossible to be in any place where God is not present. One can never be hidden from God's all-seeing eye. Now, of course, that hasn't stopped people from trying to run away and hide from God. It happens all the time, right? And I think of biblical examples. I think of Adam and Eve. They tried. I mean, they tried to hide from God, did they not? But God in his grace found them in the garden hiding after they committed the first sin. As gracious of God to reach out to them, and he did. And that should say something to us as well. Another person who tried to hide from God was Jonah, right? We know his story. He attempted to flee from the presence of God, and in his case, it went from bad to worse. He got swallowed by a whale. He thought, well, that takes care of it, but guess what? God was there with him as well. And he brought him back to the place of obedience and service. So the Lord asked in Jeremiah 23:24, can a man hide himself in hiding places so I do not see him? Is that possible? Of course not. Then he goes on to say, do I not fill the heavens and the earth, declares the Lord? Yes, you do, Lord. And because of that, you can't hide. You can't go anywhere and hide from me. I'll find you. Now, to prove that no one can outrun God and hide from him, David gives three contrasting expressions or mirisms to express the totality of God's omnipresence. The first is given in verse 8. If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. The Hebrew pronouns referring to God in this verse are abrupt, they're emphatic. This verse reads literally, if I ascend to heaven, you. That's what the literal reading is. If I make my bed in Sheol, you. See what David's doing there? He can't run. God, you're there. Turn around and there you are, you. Now that heaven and Sheol are opposites is obvious. Heaven here can refer to the place where God dwells in our future home, of course, or the universe above. In either case, God is there, right? Of course he's in his heaven, as we know it, our future home. He's there, that's where he dwells, but he's also in the universe. You know, I don't know if you remember, but the first Soviet cosmonauts irreverently joked that they didn't see God from their spaceship. That was way long, long time ago. But that's what they did. Oh, I don't see God around here. But guess what? God saw them. He was there when they were up in space. I was thinking about that this past week with the news of the New Horizons spacecraft, you know, passing Pluto after 9.5-year journey. Isn't that something? That was quite remarkable, actually. And I was watching some of that online at NASA television. You can go online and watch this stuff. And I mean, that's really interesting stuff, if you like that. And I was thinking about that this past week when it reached Pluto this past Tuesday. Guess what? God was already there. He was watching it go by Pluto. He was right there. It didn't have to take God 9.5 years to get out there. God was already there. Now, Sheol is a Hebrew word for the place where the souls of the dead went before Christ rose from the dead. Can't say much more than I don't have time to do that, but that's what was believed, that this place was called Sheol, Hades in the New Testament, it's the Greek word for it, and so before Christ rose, people went to Sheol or Hades, and one place was for the good, the believers, the other place was for the bad people, and so forth, but nonetheless, what the point David is making here is that God is there as well. That's what he's trying to say. So by linking these two places together, David is seeking to convey simply, no matter how high I go or how low I go, God is there. And if God is at the highest height and at the lowest depth, he's everywhere in between as well. That's the truth that he's trying to convey through this mirism. The second contrasting expression David uses is in verses 9 and 10. Look at these two verses. If I take the wings of the dawn, and if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, and your hand will lay hold of me. You know, as a brand new Christian back in the early 70s, who was initially in the Navy and stationed on board a nuclear submarine called the USS Thomas Jefferson, we would go out, you know, and I remember my very first patrol in the Mediterranean. And once we dove, we didn't see the sun for over 70 days. We were down that long. And I remember, you know, as we were messing around in the Mediterranean Sea, I remember coming upon this verse and saying, thank you, Lord. Thank you for it. I took it literally. I took it literally. But guess what? That's not how David really intended it. That's okay. We can still, you know, find application in those things. The contrast David is presenting in these two verses is between east and west, believe it or not. The winds of the morning is a poetic expression to describe the rays of the morning sun that flash across the sky as the sun rises. And you know, if you're ever up at dawn and you're looking out, it's dark and the sun comes up, you know, and you can see that, don't you? You see the rays of the sun just shooting out. That's what that is. The winds of the morning, he calls it. And the remotest part of the sea actually refers to the west, or the Mediterranean Sea, where the sun would set from the perspective of the Jew living in Israel. So what David had in mind was God's universal presence between east and west. Between east and west. East and west. That way, not this way. Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, east and west. That way. You see, although the distance between north and south is great, there is a point where north transitions to south and south to north. But east and west never meet. So what David is saying is that wherever a person travels in those never converging directions of east and west, guess what? God is there. That's what he's saying in this statement. Great, great stuff. The third and final contrasting expression David uses is in verses 11 to 12. Look at them. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to me, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. Now, obviously, the contrast David uses here is between darkness and light. It's obvious. You see, the cover of darkness may allow us to do things unknown to others that the light of day would expose. I'm thinking here of crimes being committed. We've got a couple of police officers here. You know, things happen at night, and criminals are pretty smart, and they know that they can do things at night that that during the day they would be quickly caught. Yes, certain kinds of criminal activity takes place primarily at night. Crimes like rape and sexual assault take place at night, as well as motor vehicle break-ins, thefts, things like that often take place at night. But according to David, whereas darkness may hide our deeds from others, it can't from God. Why? Because darkness is non-existent with God. That's hard for us to grasp because we live in a day that brings about night, you know, darkness. As David said, even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Why? Because darkness and light are alike to God. And that can be very comforting. It should be very comforting to us. In fact, because of this, David took comfort in the fact that when he thought he was all alone in the dark, he knew he was not, for he found God's presence to be like light to him in the midst of that darkness. Now, what should be our response to this wonderful truth about God's omnipresence? Well, first, God's presence in our lives should be a cause for comfort and confidence. A cause for comfort and confidence. Although, as we just saw, God's presence is universal, there is a unique and special manifestation of his presence in each of our lives as his children. And that's, we want to bring it down to us. God's presence is real for us, my friends, us. That he will never leave nor forsake his people, as Hebrews 12:5 promises, I suggest to you, is an indescribable blessing that is ours as believers, and one that we can take comfort in this morning. God will never, ever leave us or forsake us. Second, a conscious awareness of God's presence in our lives should also generate a fearlessness in us. A fearlessness in us that defies natural understanding. I'm thinking here of and when we find ourselves in the dark and dangerous places of life. You see, the darkness that can be so fearful to us, I remind you, in light of the truth that we just looked at, is non-existent to God. That darkness is non-existent to God. So our awareness of his presence should dispel the fear that oftentimes comes when we enter those dark moments. We just need to latch our minds on the fact that the Lord is with us. He is with us. And we don't have to be fearful. We don't have to be fearful. In fact, it can generate, should generate, a fearlessness in us that defies natural understanding. Third, this truth of God's presence in our lives should serve as a warning and incentive for purity of life, for purity. You know, it is sobering to realize that every sin is committed with God watching. I mean, that's very sobering to think about that. What we think is done in secret is not. For God sees every sin as if it's been committed in the light of day in front of everybody. God sees everything. And so it should serve as a warning and incentive for purity. And then fourth and finally, regardless of how remote, isolated, or desolated the places we find ourselves, the Lord is right there to lead us. Regardless of how remote, isolated, or desolated the places we find ourselves, the Lord is right there. Paul testified to that. When he was going through all those trials, he said the Lord stood right next to him. He felt his presence. Interestingly, the word lead that David uses in verse 10 is the same word he used back in Psalm 23, where he writes in verse 3 concerning our shepherd Lord, he leads me beside quiet waters. So we can be confident of that he's with us. No matter where we are in this world, he's right there with his hand upon us, leading us. In fact, that word hold found there in verse 10 as well has the notion of grasping or holding fast to something. This suggesting the Lord is securely holding tight to us when we go through those rough times in life. The point is, again, that God is constantly with us, so we might as well live like he is. That's the challenge here. That this truth about God, these truths, would so affect us that we would live our lives accordingly. Well, in just a few minutes, we're going to close our service with the observance of the Lord's Supper. How appropriate. How appropriate is that? Because there is no better time than during communion to be reminded that in spite of knowing us thoroughly, in spite of having, you know, a front row seat to our lives, which God does, God, who sent his Son to die for our sins, he still loves us unconditionally. Think about that. He knows everything about us. He knows all of our secret sins. He knows every thought. Everything. We can't hide anything about it. And yet, he still loves us unconditionally. This we can be confident of because, as these verses have shown us this morning, we are the object of God's loving attention and care every moment of every day. Do you believe that? I hope so, because that's truth, my friends. That's truth. And I suggest that there's no greater love than that. Of course, Christ offering himself is the greatest love, but this would be right next to it. That God still loves us as he does unconditionally after he knows all the garbage that he does about us. He still loves us. What a wonderful God. So let's rejoice in this reality of God's omniscience and omnipresence as we partake of the elements of the Lord's Supper together this morning. Invite the men that I